welcome to the Direction Democracy podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. This podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's upcoming national agenda series, Direction Democracy, which will examine where we've been, where we're going, and the current state of democracy in the United States. I'm your host, Tom Byrne, news director at Delaware Public Media. And as we get closer to the start of the new school year and the national agenda series itself, we are joined on this episode by the UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, who also teaches communication and political science. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. I always like to be here.
Now, we will talk a little bit later on about some of the speakers who are coming in for the Direction Democracy National Agenda Series. That list does include, just to give people a little bit of a tease, Chris Christie. But first, I do want to talk a little bit about some of the things that have been kind of percolating over the summer since our first episode of this podcast back in May. And certainly of late, mass shootings and the response to them have been center stage. Many Democrats, including those running for president, have renewed their calls for legislation to address guns and gun violence. They've also been vocal about tracing at least some of this violence to white nationalism and President Trump, who they say incites it with what he says and what he tweets. Some have even gone as far as to call the president a white nationalist. My question to start with you is, what's your take on what seems to be a more pointed effort now by Democrats to move on this issue and maybe make this a signature issue against the president in next year's election?
I think that, you know, with every one of these mass shootings that occurs, it reignites the attention to the issue. How long that lasts, I'm not sure. You know, last year with the Parkland shooting, It really seemed like that was going to be an issue that was going to be very important to people. And there is some evidence that in 2018, this was an issue for voters, for Democratic voters. And I think a lot of Democratic gun control groups believe that this is going to be a winning issue in 2020. So I think that it makes sense that a lot of candidates are going in that direction. One thing I think is kind of interesting is that of the six Democratic candidates who don't have a clear gun plan, Joe Biden is the most prominent one that doesn't actually have a stated plan on his website. Maybe that's to come, but him being kind of the safest candidate right now, I'm really going to be looking to what he says. Is he going to let it slide? Are the more extreme candidates going to take on this issue, the more progressive candidates? You know, that's kind of what I'm looking for.
Yeah, no, his people have said that they do have a plan coming. It is in the works, or at least going to be rolled out at some point. And I do think just kind of listening to him talk about it in the wake of these shootings, he has kind of folded it into his kind of battle for the soul of the nation narrative. And so that's kind of where he's taken it, at least in the short term. But you're right, I think to be competitive this year, there's going to have to be some kind of very explicit plan, particularly when you have other candidates, particularly the Elizabeth Warrens and the Kamala Harrises, who are very strong on this issue and have very clear plans of where they want to go.
And I think the visibility of these gun control groups like Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense and some other groups are gaining a lot of visibility in news media. They're getting interviewed. I'm seeing them, their pictures plastered on the front page of the newspaper. So those groups are being given more legitimacy than I've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's definitely something to watch. I think that, in certain states, it's really a bad idea to have this conversation. I read a piece in Politico. A former Iowa state senator, Tom Courtney, said, if you want to talk to Iowa voters about gun control, he said, basically, in Iowa, that's crazy talk. This is not something you want to do in some of these states. So it'll be interesting to see how the candidates navigate, particularly those first two primary caucus states, but other states that have a very very strong gun culture.
Yeah, because I think that you do run the risk of being a candidate, because in this particular election, particularly with so many candidates, you have to run almost simultaneously nationally and also in these individual states. And if there is situations where those two things kind of bump into each other, it can be a more difficult thing to navigate than in the past, when really early on in the campaign, you went to Iowa and you talked about ethanol. And, you went here or there and you talked about specific issues. But now, because you need to get into the debates, the donors, the number of donors, the money, the polling, you really do have to be speaking across the nation simultaneously to those first couple states. That's tough.
Yeah, it's a double bind. It's hard to, you're speaking out of two sides of your mouth. and it's hard to, would not want to be one of these candidates, because you're exactly right. They have to gain that national profile in order to seem electable, to seem that they have what it takes, but then they also have to connect with people on the ground in these early states. And that's a difficult task to do.
And that's particularly important right now because the bar for the September debates is a little bit higher in terms of donors and polling. So there are a lot of those candidates who are, as we say in the sports world, when it comes to the NCAA tournament, on the bubble and trying to get off the bubble and into the debates themselves. I did find it interesting that there is a bit of a divide on Democrats on this issue between those who are calling President Trump a white nationalist and those who stop short of that and just kind of condemn what he says, how he says it. And I'm wondering if that's also a bit of a precursor to a decision Democrats are going to need to make in this election. Do they try to go toe-to-toe with Trump in terms of language and rhetoric, or try to say, no, we're not like that, we're above the fray? I've seen a number of different arguments where people say, no, you have to call it out. You have to call him on it. You can't kind of, you know, ignore it. Where others seem to feel like you're playing into his hand by kind of getting into that kind of debate over language. What do you think?
That's a tough question. I think one piece that I read recently out from NPR, Gene Demby, who runs the a podcast there, he kind of reminded me that white nationalist violence is embedded in the history of American politics. And I think when we bring up, like, is he white nationalist? Or do we use this language? I think Demby makes a really good point that this is who we are as a nation. Mm-hmm. I think we need to come to that place and say, yes, we have institutionalized racism in this country. It's systemic. Even during Jim Crow, he mentions 4,000 lynchings. Those lynchings were an extra legal expression of official policy, which was that black people are inferior. So this often comes up. It comes up all the time with so many issues. And I think from a communication perspective and from a social science perspective, I sort of just want people to admit, yeah, yes, of course. All of this is rooted in white nationalism and racism. That's something that this country needs to address, needs to accept, come to a place where we accept that that is who we are and begin to move forward.
And even locally, we have seen that. We saw the lynching memorial that was put up, and within weeks, someone took it down and stole it here in Delaware. And do we know why the person did that? No, but there's reason to suspect that someone found it, like, oh, I can't believe we're spending time, like, memorializing lynchings. And so even here, locally, within the last month or so, we see this same kind of undercurrent of trying to come to grips with this past.
Right. And, I mean, our school systems, and I'm getting students coming into college who don't know what a minstrel show it was, or who don't know what Jim Crow means or where that term came from. And we need to educate our young people about the dark places of our past so that we do not repeat them. And I think because we don't educate them, we're seeing a lot of these are young white men who are committing some of these crimes, who are radicalized online by other young white men who have also not been given a proper education or perspective on the history of this nation. So it's a very toxic place to be right now. And I think when it comes to the language, I'm less concerned about, is Trump a racist, is Trump a this or that, than just saying this nation is rooted in institutionalized racism. Let's come to grips with that and accept it and stop worrying about the language so much.
And I do think we also see that a little bit, and we saw in the first couple of debates, at least one of them, where the issue of reparations came up. And there seems to be a little bit of a divide there as well as to whether or not this is an issue that that people want to tackle head on, whether presidential candidates want to jump into that pool and talk about it directly, or not make it an election issue, but maybe deal with it at a later time.
Yeah, and the fact that it came up at all was sort of surprising to me, but I think it's evidence that we are getting to a place where we need to have this conversation. And, you know, National Agenda 4 years ago was about race in this country, and it continues. That was shortly after Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these things keep popping up. And like I said, unless we deal with the root of this issue and kind of get a good history lesson on where we are and why we're here in this democracy, I think that it's going to be difficult to move forward. So I think that we need to understand that white nationalism has just always been part of who we are as a nation. And we may like that, we may dislike that, but acknowledging that fact to me is really important.
But we do have a history as a nation of kicking this can down the road. I mean, starting with the actual Constitution itself and even the Declaration of Independence, where there was that debate over whether or not, you know, these things should be included, whether they should, you know, be dealt with in, you know, in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence. And generally speaking, the founders said, we can't start this nation. We won't even get started if we try to tackle it now. We'll let the next generation do that. And it just seems like that's been a pattern throughout.
Hundreds of years later.
Exactly.
So what's it going to take? That's the question.
Well, we did talk a little bit about, you mentioned the debates, and I do want to talk to you a little bit about those. Specifically, I guess, what are your takeaways from these first two debates? Did we learn much, if anything, from them? Was there anything that stood out to you in terms of, you know, with 20 candidates on two nights, you know, can anything really be learned from that type of format and that type of style?
Unfortunately, I think that, you know, debates, as these have existed for, you know, 20, 30 years, are really just a way to bring attention to somebody with some quip or some funny thing that they do or say. And they're not really going to give us any viewpoint on the issues where these candidates stand. They were also given such a limited amount of time to talk. You can't really get any substance from that. And when you look at the viewership numbers, people weren't really paying attention. So I don't think that these debates are playing a big role right now. I certainly think in the general election debates play a much more important role, but still, it's more about demeanor. It's more about, you know, what was said that was memorable. I'm not a puppet. You're a puppet. You're the puppet.
Right.
So at this point, I don't think they're playing that big a role in people's perceptions of the candidates, other than if you, as an underdog, do something that makes you stand out. That's where I think you can have an advantage right now. But I think the other thing that I really wanted to talk about with the debates is we have more women on that stage both nights than we've really ever seen before. And it was interesting to see the dynamic of how the men communicated or spoke over the women candidates. We know that from research that that men interrupt women far more than women interrupt men. There's a lot of research to suggest that. But what happens is that male candidates can interrupt where women face, as Professor Tali Mendelberg says, they face sort of a double bind. You can either stay silent and fail to be heard or speak up and get judged as being too aggressive. So it puts women in a difficult position, and it was something that was very noticeable to me.
And it's funny because it's an issue of, I remember even going back to when Joe Biden debated Sarah Palin, that there was a lot of discussion about this type of interaction. How does a man interact with a woman in that type of setting? And I think in that case, one-on-one, it's probably a little bit easier to navigate than in this situation, where there is kind of like a benefit or an advantage or some gain to be made by being the person who jumps in and cuts someone off and says something and, you know, challenges somebody on something. And in this type of situation, it was a very different dynamic overall, but particularly in how this worked out.
Yeah, I thought a suggestion from Adam Grant, who's at the Wharton School, suggested, what if we just muted the debate mics when it's not the candidate's turn? Or he said, at least start playing the Oscar music. So there could be some technological tools that could help with this, because we do know that when women, they're interrupted more frequently, but when they're interrupted, women are much more likely to stay out of the conversation after that. So we really need to, I think, I think it's not going to happen, but if it were me, I would like to revise the whole debate format to be more of an interview setting or some case that gives the candidate room to talk, that they don't have to just repeat 30-second talking points and interrupt in order to get attention.
Yeah, it's hard because I think the candidates see a value in the quips. Certainly the television networks see a value. That's, you know, you mentioned they weren't watched that much, but the people who are watching are, you get the feeling, largely watching to see those moments, maybe
right.
Not necessarily the actual substance.
And is that good for our democracy? I don't know.
And it was interesting because even the second night of the second round, there was this kind of, again, like kind of narrative that kind of grew out of it. They're like, wow, that whole first part where they talked about healthcare was like so wonky, and, you know, that must have just had people glazing their eyes over. It's like, but isn't that what we want to know, what people, what these candidates want to do with healthcare and what their plans actually are? And, you know, yes, maybe sometimes we have to convince people that paying attention to the wonky stuff is maybe worth your while a little bit and not criticize it. It's like, well, that was terrible. People must have turned the debate off once that started happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a perpetual problem that, you know, a lot of people don't really want to get in the weeds. And politics is entertainment now that's intertwined. And so this is really, that's why we call it a horse race, because this is sports. People are betting on this. You know, it's become a new form of entertainment. And again, I ask citizens to think, like, is that really who we want to be as a democracy?
Since you brought up the horse race, okay, I'm going to go there a little bit. And it would appear, looking at the latest polling, that the former Vice President Joe Biden is still the front runner for the Democratic nomination. After the two debates, most people kind of considered that he didn't have a great performance in the first one, but kind of rallied in the second one. But beyond that, I think the two candidates who seem to have made the most gains over the summer and those couple of debates were Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris. And while they all win head-to-head polls, at least the most recent ones when you put it, they're put up against President Trump, Biden seems to have the strongest numbers both in the head-to-head matchup and when they start framing the question a little bit differently in more of the who's the most electable type of frame. And I've heard some people argue this is kind of the Biden as the safe candidate. I'm calling it the comfort food argument that, well, it's an important election. You know, if you're a Democrat, you feel like Trump has to be beaten, so you can't take any risks. He's the guy who we're pretty sure can get the job done. But others suggest that there's also something else here, and that is, you know, particularly when it comes to Warren and Harris, that there's a gender factor at work. I'm curious how you see it. Maybe it's multiple things that are kind of at work here, or what?
I think you're absolutely right. This is a multifaceted issue, and I have a couple of polls that I found recently that I think shed some light on this. Quinnipiac did a poll where they asked people basically the horse race question. If the election were held today, who would you vote for? And Biden, as you mentioned, took first place with that 29% saying they would vote for him if the primary were held today. The next person who was a woman candidate who came up was Warren, but that was at 16%, mm-hmm. So it's about half. But they did this really interesting thing where they also asked the question, if you had a magic wand and can make any of the candidates president, they don't have to beat anyone or win the election. So in other words, you don't have to worry about electability.
Who do you really want?
Yeah, who do you really want? If you could really just pick anybody. And there we see Warren on top with 21% and 19% tapping Biden and Sanders. So that's a pretty remarkable difference. So that's going to be a really interesting thing to look for. Are people looking for electability or are they looking for their dream candidate? And we also see, I think, for Democratic women in particular, Democratic men and women, but particularly women, they're really aspirational towards seeing a female candidate in their lifetimes. Pew did some research that shows that that among the Democrats, about 68% of women Democrats said they would hope to see a woman elected in their lifetime. And men, Democratic men were at 56%, so a little bit less, but this is far different from Republicans who are in the 20% saying they hope to see a female candidate. So I think this is an issue that a female candidate could absolutely run on. I think we've seen people like Amy Klobuchar and others really citing their womanhood, mm-hmm. if you will, as part of the debates, as part of their campaigns. So that's going to appeal to, I think, a lot of Democratic women. How that's going to appeal to other folks, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think, again, there's a lot of layers to this, right? I mean, I think a lot of this idea of, like, Biden as electable and finding the most electable candidate and maybe that kind of, you know, looking at whether or not a Warren or a Harris can win, people draw the line to Hillary Clinton. Like, well, we had Hillary Clinton and she couldn't beat Trump, so why do we want to try something like that again? But then again, you look at what happened in the midterms, and women did very, very well locally, nationally, I mean, pretty much everywhere. And, you know, many people have noted that Harris and Warren have never lost an election that they've run in, while the male candidates at the top of the polls, Biden and Sanders, have lost elections. So it seems like there a lot of people are of two minds. And depending on what they tend to focus on, if you focus on what happened in the last election with Hillary Clinton, you may be more inclined to say, let's go with Biden. If you look at what's kind of the trend line through the midterms is, maybe you start to say, like, hey, this is the time to, like, make that move and put our votes with a woman.
Well, let's keep in mind context here, because what happened between 2016 and 2018 was the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. And a lot of women coming out and expressing stories of personal sexual assault and harassment. And that really united women in a way that I haven't really seen before. And I think that the women who ran on those kinds of issues in 2018 did well. Are we going to see another movement like that? Are we going to see another Black Lives Matter resurgence? Right. There could be a lot of things that come to play. And the candidates are going to have to be willing to jump on whatever the current tide is and mm-hmm. really be a strong in their language about what Americans are really caring about. So I think, as every academic is going to tell you, and every pollster, well, maybe not pollsters, but I will tell you, it doesn't really matter right now. I mean, it's fun, it's entertaining, but I don't know if the polling numbers are really telling us a clear story of what's going to happen in 2020. And in some ways, I made this note as I was thinking about this, is that polling has become so ubiquitous that it almost seems like we need to know what other people are thinking before we can make a decision ourselves. And I feel like we're becoming too reliant on polls. We've sort of co-opted polls to replace doing our own research,
right.
doing our own, what's this candidate like? And as someone who does public opinion polling and studies public opinion as part of my career, it kind of saddens me to say that, like, maybe we need less polling, but part of me thinks maybe we need less polling.
Well, let's move on. As I promised, we do want to talk about this year's National Agenda Series speakers. As we mentioned at the top of the podcast, topping the list is former New Jersey Governor and UD alum Chris Christie. Let's start with him. When's he going to be here, and what will he be discussing specifically?
Well, Governor Christie is, we're very excited to have him back. He is a UD alum. He graduated with a political science degree here, and he was here in 2011 as a sitting governor, but he hasn't been back since then, so we're very excited to welcome him back. And it turns out this series, every year has a theme. This year we're focused on direction democracy, where we've been, where we are, where we're going, and I'm putting a particular focus on citizenship, the role of citizens, how that's changed, and also civil dialogue. Where and when can we speak about politics? So Chris Christie seemed like a very interesting person to talk about how you talk about politics, because he's often very brash, very forward. He's just published a book in the last year about in-your-face politics. He's starting a new institute at Seton Hall, also an alum there, looking at bringing people together, actually creating sort of civic dialogue, and he's actually moderating his first lecture with a bipartisan theme with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. So that's how he's starting his series off. I'm going to have him here November 6th. They're all on Wednesdays. It's at 7:30 in Mitchell Hall. And as usual, we'll have that as the podcast. We'll have that on YouTube and a transcript available. But yeah, he's a pretty big one. We also have...
Yeah, I was going to say, who else do we have?
Yeah, I'm also excited. Another Delawarean, not a UD alum, but a Delawarean, Dan Pfeiffer, who is the co-host of the very popular political podcast, Pod Save America, also a former Obama staffer. And this podcast is so popular, people buy T-shirts and hats and all this swag just so they can get to ask a question at the live podcasts. So some of the students that I've told about Dan coming are beyond excited. We have a great slate of other speakers scheduled as well. Our second speaker is Rob Rogers. That's on September 11th. I forgot to mention Dan Pfeiffer's here September 4th. So that's coming
right off
very soon.
Right off the bat.
Right off the bat. And every event is 7:30 at Mitchell Hall on UD's campus. But our second speaker is Rob Rogers. He's a political cartoonist who made headlines a year or so ago when he was fired from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for his anti-Trump cartoons. So cartooning has been something that, when you think about the direction of our democracy, has played a really important role throughout the long history of this democracy. So I'm going to be very fascinated to talk with him, not only about his experience being fired for his viewpoint, because the editorial board had kind of shifted their viewpoints, but just about cartooning in general. We also have, in September, political columnist for the New York Times, Jamel Bowie. That's September 25th at 7:30. He covers a lot about public policy, elections, and race. So he does a lot of culture stuff as well. He actually was named Forbes 30 Under 30 in media just a couple years ago. So he's certainly a journalist to watch. On October 2nd, we're actually switching to a more conservative perspective. So I tried to make this as bipartisan as possible. So October 2nd, we have Tara Setmeyer. She is a CNN political contributor and the former GOP communications director. She's a woman of color, but who's also a Republican and is also anti-Trump. So I'm very interested in kind of understanding her perspective. Yeah. Chris Christie, of course, again, is November 6th. And our final speaker is nonpartisan. His name is John Della Volpa. He is a Harvard pollster who's been measuring millennials and young people's attitudes about politics for the past 20 years or so. So I'm hoping he can give us a good insight. I know I just bashed polling a little bit earlier, but I'm hoping he can give us a good insight on what we can expect from young people come 2020.
All right. Well, we appreciate you giving us the rundown on that. As we finish up, we're going to do what we always do and go with our political quick take, your hot quick take, your quick hot take, however you want to look at it. What is on your mind for the political quick take?
Well, I was alerted to this obituary in the New York Times by my colleague, Nancy Karapjanian, and she sends me this obituary, and she says, don't go to the end, don't read the end, just read it. I'm not going to tell you why, just read it. So I read it. It's about this woman who, you know, unfortunately died at just 54. Her name is Catherine Brandt. So it starts off like any obituary. She died at home in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 4th, 2019, under the care of her family with the expert guidance of the University of Virginia Palliative Care Clinic. It turns out she actually championed hospice and palliative care for more than 30 years, working to improve timely access to quality care. So a life well lived. What happened that was really unexpected is the end of the obituary reads, from the time Kathy was diagnosed with clear cell ovarian cancer 6 months ago, she was clear with her family that the cause of death should be listed as the Trump presidency in her obituary. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that donations be sent to whichever candidate secures the Democratic nomination, even if you really wish someone better were running. So I'm interested to kind of follow the comments that appear on this obituary, but I'm wondering, is this a new phenomenon? Is this like political participation post, you know, post-life? It's, you know, participating from beyond the grave. It's something I haven't really seen before, so I'm curious if it's a trend that we're going to start seeing on the obituary page.
It would not surprise me. Well, I'm going to give you my political quick take, which is probably more of a journalistic take. As we've heard in the last week, apparently the Trump administration and the president himself are dabbling with the idea of buying Greenland, even though Greenland is not for sale. And I'm really not interested in the politics of buying Greenland or whether buying Greenland would be a good idea or not. Maybe it's a beef or it's just kind of a concern is that the amount of attention the media paid to something that isn't really real. I mean, it's like, I understand you can't ignore that the president or someone from his staff kind of leaked it and then they wound up asking him about it. But Greenland's not for sale. The government is not, they're not selling Greenland and it can't be bought anytime soon. So these like long articles that detail how the United States has bought other places and Harry Truman considered buying Greenland back and like, it's not a story. It's
like, but how many clicks did it get though?
It's like, I understand you can't ignore it, but man, I wish we could ignore it because it's like, there's so many other things that deserve a lot more attention than whether or not the president wants to buy Greenland or not.
Well, what I always say to when I do teach journalism students is like, you can use something like that to get people's attention, but then get to the important stuff. Like, why is this unprecedented? I think it is interesting if other presidents have tried to do something like this, but I think it's, you know, I always say it's like, you know, serving broccoli but covering it in cheese. So people can have the fun, have the entertainment, but then hopefully get something else out of it.
I suppose, but it still bothers me.
I get it.
Dr. Lindsay Hoppen, the Associate Director for the UD Center for Political Communication and the Director of the National Agenda Series. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. We look forward to the next one, which will be right as we're getting into the series itself. So thank you.
Yes, it's going to be very exciting.
Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you again next time on the Direction Democracy podcast.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Direction Democracy podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more information on the UD Center for Political Communications Direction Democracy National Agenda Series this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu.